As a Christian, do you have to take abuse lying down or standing up? Sometimes we come up with the idea that the Christian attitude is one of complete subjection. That as a Christian, we do not have any rights that we normally associate with being ill-used. That we must demonstrate the so-called Christian attitude and be meek and complacent at all times. One man said he didn't mind people walking over him if they didn't have spikes in their shoes. I suppose to explain the principle involved here, it might be well to use a story. I received a sort of an emergency call one time in my office. It seemed that a church building program, which had been in progress several hundred miles away, had completely bogged down. The work on the church was stopped, and there wasn't any money coming into the treasury, into the building fund. Nor was there any in the building fund. They simply sent an SOS, would I come over and help them? Now, I'm quite positive that they were thinking about money, but I wasn't, because I knew that money was not the problem. But why try to explain it by letter over a telephone? I simply agreed on a date, packed my bags, and took off. When I arrived, I found a very unusual situation. The pastor of the church was an intern just out of college. No doubt he came out all fired with ambition. He was going to do evangelism, and he had probably had a whole book full of ideas about how to operate a church successfully. And here he walked straight into the middle of a church that was split down the center as vividly as the aisle. Some people weren't talking to other people, and there was a bitter feeling there. It was one of those strange situations, as he related it to me. There was a very strong individual in the church who liked to have his own way and didn't believe too much in the democratic process, it seemed, because when they would take a certain vote, he would countermand this vote on his own. So when they decided to have a certain type of paneling, they got a different kind. As an example, when they picked out the type of rug they were going to have, he said they're going to be surprised when they see what they got. And they were, because it wasn't what they voted at all. This bothered some other people, especially another man. He thought the democratic process was being very sadly misused, and he didn't like it at all. And he voiced his opinion, and beside that, he quit coming to church. Now, I couldn't quite understand why he quit coming to church. After all, it wasn't the Lord's fault. I could understand why he might feel a little upset, because after all, when a church board or a building committee takes a vote, we should follow that. One man shouldn't be a voice for the whole. I could understand that. So the church more or less lined up behind these two men. They lined up behind the former man because, after all, he did get things done and had a very powerful personality. They lined up behind the other man because they felt that he had a right to feel the way he did. Of course, what they didn't know, and what I am well aware of, is that the devil many times uses these type of things to get people to quit giving at all. As a matter of fact, he was highly successful, because they quit giving, the church came to a complete stop. And, of course, the devil isn't interested in having us build churches to the glory of God at all. And so he really was winning. I was at a total loss to know exactly what I ought to do. Certainly, I couldn't preach anything on the subject because the man who really ought to hear wasn't there, hadn't been there for 2 or 3 months, and I would... I could say that I was happy when it came time for the benediction. The reason I say that is because you could feel this kind of an atmosphere, atmosphere of disunity. You could feel it. In the afternoon, my wife and I went over to see this church. It was a sad thing, really. Is there anything sadder than a house built for God and is sitting there, nothing's going on? It didn't need too much to be finished. Probably a month would finish the church and still nothing was going on. I had been praying that the Lord would give me an answer, but I didn't know how it was going to work out. We heard some ladies' voices, and very soon a group of three or four ladies came around the corner. And one of these ladies was the wife of the man who was not attending church. When she saw me, she came over and greeted me. And she said, I'd like to have you and your wife come out to my house for lunch this evening. And I said, we'd be very happy to. I didn't even wait to see whether my wife was agreeable or not. I wanted to see her husband. Now, I knew him. I knew he didn't have anything against me. I'd eaten at his house before. I'd been on picnics with him, but I wanted to see him. But I wanted to see him under a circumstance where I was his guest rather than I came out to see him and put my finger in the doorbell and said, I came out to see you. You're wrong. You have a right to feel the way you do, but you're wrong. I didn't want that to happen. When we arrived there, my wife suggested that she would help with the lunch. And my hostess showed me to a very comfortable chair in the living room and then went to the hall and called and said, oh, dear, Elder Reese is here. And she came back and said, he'll be out very soon. And there I sat. No dear. His wife went off into the kitchen. And finally, after a while, she looked around the corner. There I was sitting by myself. She was terribly embarrassed. Oh, she said, oh my. And she went to the hall and gave the dear call again. In fact, it took two of these before she got him out. When he came out, whew, did he come out? He said, do you believe in the democratic process? And I said, I certainly do. And then he sat down and he just proceeded to just pour out a multitude of words. He told me the whole story. I'd heard it all before. The whole story. All over again. Well, I sat there, not paying too much attention to what he was saying because I'd already heard it. I sat there only thinking, Lord, and praying, saying, Lord, what am I going to tell this man? He has a right to feel the way he does. I probably would feel that way too, but what should I tell him? After he finished, I said, I know you're telling the truth because I'd already heard it once before. Then he came over and sat down in the Davenport beside me, or Davenport, and he said, what do you think we should do? Well, I said, why are you building a church? Well, he listed excuses like we need more room, we need a foyer, we need more room for the divisions, all this type of thing. None of these would I accept. I was facetious, I know. I meant to be. I wanted to get the answer from him that I felt was of prime importance. When he finally said, we're building a church for evangelism, soul winning, I said, okay, I'll buy that. Because why else do we build churches? Certainly, we build churches to where we can worship God. We build churches where we can fellowship together. But we can worship God in the new earth, and we can fellowship in the new earth. Why do we build churches down here? The primary purpose has to be to give the gospel to the world, and then we can get out of here. So then I ask him, can you do successful evangelism without the Holy Spirit? Well, he readily admitted that you can't. Now the clincher. Can you have the Holy Spirit work in your midst if you are not unified? Reluctantly, he said, I guess not. And then he said, what should I do? First it was we, now it became I. What should I do? I found myself speaking the words the Lord had placed in my mouth. I recall having no conscious thought of the words. I mean of the thought, only the words. And they thrilled me as I heard myself saying to him, you may have a right to feel the way you do, but you dare not exercise that right if it'll bring disunity. You may have the right to feel the way you do, but you dare not exercise it if it'll bring disunity. He didn't say whether he believed it or not. His wife about that time called us for lunch, and immediately following lunch, we had to go to a meeting where we had asked the men of the church to come together to talk about the new church building program. As soon as we got in the car, I said to my wife, quick, get pencil and paper. I don't want to lose this, because all during the meal, I had been repeating silently to myself, you may have the right to feel the way you do, but you dare not exercise it if it'll bring disunity or disharmony. When we got to the church, the young pastor said, I wonder if you'd do me a favor, and I agreed I would if I could. He said, will you chair the meeting, because I'm afraid. I said, well, I'm afraid too, but I'll do the best I can. We didn't have a song because who felt like singing? We did have prayer. We prayed that God's blessing would be with us, His presence would be there. The agenda was rather simple. I said we came to talk about the new church. I was out and looked at it. It's going to be a beautiful building when it's finished, but it evidently needs a little more work. And there seems to be a problem, so let's talk about it. I really didn't need any more agenda. I listened very carefully and felt that I shouldn't be talking, saying anything, and so I didn't. All I was listening for was if in the heat of argument they might get a little personal. And I didn't want this to happen, because sometimes people can say things that are a little hard to forget. One time it got a little warm, and I stopped. I looked very intently at that particular spot in the church, and it cooled off, and I relaxed again. I would say that we covered the subject rather thoroughly for the third time, as far as I was concerned. And finally, the discussion ended, and I was wondering what I should do. Where should we go from here? What should be the next step? When this man stood up over at one side where he was more or less isolated by himself, and he said almost belligerently, all right, I've had my say. I think I have a perfect right to feel the way I do. And he almost, the word just came tumbling out. But he said, I shouldn't have exercised that right because it brought disunity, and I'm asking each one of you to forgive me. Well, you can only imagine the effect on the rest of the church. It just became deathly silent. Here is a man who has the right to feel the way he does, but now he's asking people, all the church, to forgive him. I'll tell you, when the Lord gets through to a person, he really gets through, doesn't he? In this silence, a man got up over on one side and walked around behind me, around the front and over to him. I wondered, what's he going to do? When he got over there, he put his hand on his shoulder and he said, you know, brother, I have said a lot of unkind things about you in the last few months. I want you to forgive me. And then we had people forgiving people all over everywhere. I just got back out of the way. I saw tears, people putting their arms around each other. It was a fantastic experience. I thank God for that message which he had for that man. You may have the right to feel the way you do, but you dare not exercise it. What is the trap? The devil has a real trap here. To a person wronged, he suggests feelings of bitterness or revenge. Now, notice the common results which we can expect when people say harsh things about other people or do things that aren't nice. First, a person can defend his right, he can blow up, then he can be filled with hatred and retaliation. Certainly that's not Christian. On the other hand, he can deny that he has any rights, he clams up. He has feelings of bitterness. This will end in feelings of depression. It's a known fact that most people react very well to calamities. But they do not react very well to minor irritations. React very well to calamities, but not to minor irritations. We need to take a lesson from the trees. Have you ever noticed that when the wind blows, you'll see a large, stately tree, how it'll move this way and it'll move that way? we need to bend a bit also. We need to beware that we don't stand stiff and judge another person's behavior and his words by our own beliefs and viewpoints. We need to remember that sometimes we irritate other people. We need to learn to bend with these things. But like the great tree, as quick as the wind has passed, there we are, straight again. But we learn to bend with it. If we learn to control our reactions, then people or situations will have no power over us. Once we absorb the fact that our reactions are the results of our own choosing, then we will find it'll be much easier to adapt to any situation. But as a Christian, let's ask this question. Why do we have these irritations? Wouldn't one think that if he were going to follow the Lord, that everything would be smooth? He wouldn't have to worry. Here is the principle. There is a high standard to which we are to attain if we would be children of God, noble, pure, holy, undefiled, and a pruning process is necessary. Isn't that interesting? Comes from Testimonies to the Church, Volume 5, page 344. A pruning process is necessary. This seems so strange to me until I suddenly remembered. When we moved into the country, we planted some peach trees. And a friend of mine who raises peaches told me that he would come and prune the trees so that they would have the right shape. So in a couple of years, he came down to prune my peach trees. My wife and I were proud of these, and she went with us as we went out to watch this pruning process. Before long, she couldn't stand it any longer. She went back to the house. Well, I stood there, and it was all I could do to control myself, because our beloved trees, which we'd given such loving care, most of them seemed to be on the ground as far as I was concerned, because he cut off more than he left. He came to eat a bite of lunch with us that evening, and so as we went into the house, he was in washing up, and my wife whispered to me, "Is there any left?" And I said, "Yeah, there's a few stumps out there." What were we after? Did he cut off the trees because he just had a sharp saw? No, we were after peaches, great big lush peaches. And you do not get great big lush peaches unless you carefully prune the tree. All the dead wood must be taken away and at least 2/3 of everything else. So I'm told. Now, in the Christian, there has to be a pruning process. And life is disciplinary. While in the world, the Christian will meet with adverse influences. There will be provocations to test the temper. And it's by meeting these in the right spirit that the Christian graces are developed. If insults and injuries are meekly borne, if insulting words are responded to by gentle answers, and oppressive acts by kindness, this is evidence that the Spirit of Christ dwells in the heart. The Spirit of Christ is love. Love for the lovely and love for the unlovely. And the heart where the love reigns, or this love reigns, will be guided to a gentle, courteous, compassionate course of conduct towards others, whether they suit your fancy or not. It's that simple. We have been directed to 1 Corinthians 13, verses 4 to 7. I would like to read these from the New English Bible. Love is patient, love is kind, and envies no one. Love is never boastful, not conceited, nor rude, never selfish, not quick to take offense. Love keeps no score of wrongs. Isn't that interesting? It's so easy to remember what someone did 20, 30, 40 years ago. But love does not keep any score of wrongs. It does not gloat over other men's sins, but delights in the truth. There is nothing love cannot face. There's no limit to its faith, its hope, and its endurance. And we're told that this is the most valuable treatise on the subject of etiquette that's ever been penned. Love, this Christ-like love in the heart, actually places a person in a position of positive command. He may have the right to feel the way he does, but he does not exercise this right if it will cause adverse circumstances. Paul penned this beautifully in Romans 12:21. Paul said, "Be not overcome with evil." That's the horizontal position. but overcome evil with good, and that is the vertical position. Do you see how it works now? It puts a person in a position of positive command, not being overcome with evil, but overcoming evil with good. How do we do this? Let's get into the practice. First, vengeance belongs to God. You're well acquainted with the text in Romans 12:19. Vengeance is mine, I will repay, saith the Lord. Second, be forgiving. The principle is found in Ephesians 4:32. And be ye kind one to another, tender-hearted, forgiving one another, even as God for Christ's sake hath forgiven you. And this is Christianity in action. Now let's put it into practice. This great principle of having the right but not exercising it. How about in the home? One of the most beautiful principles of this is found in early writings, page 119. If pride and selfishness were laid aside, 5 minutes would remove most difficulties. So many times in the home, it's our pride or our selfishness that gets us into trouble. And we inadvertently say something we shouldn't say, and the partner reacts. And this reaction causes another reaction, and pretty quick we have problems. I like what the young wife said to me one night. She said, when I want to argue, my husband asked me this question, which would you rather be, right or nice? I thought this was so interesting, so I said, well, which would you rather be? Well, she said, I'd rather be nice, but can't I be right just part of the time? But we put a control on our actions in the home, and then it's a Christ-like place where the angels love to dwell. How about in business? Volume 7 of the Testimonies to the Church, 143. In their business life, Christ's followers are to be light bearers to the world. I had one of those very strange experiences. I walked into a store, a small store. I was the only customer. I passed a man as I went in. He was coming out. There was one clerk. I wanted to know where a certain product was, and I asked very courteously, could you please tell me where it was? And she literally tore my head off. What do you think I am? And she just went on. And it was such a strange response that I stood there looking puzzled. The feeling inside of me was one that, let me see the manager and find out what kind of a place this is. And then I remembered what I teach, and so I said to her, I'm terribly sorry. I didn't mean to irritate you. And she covered her face with her hands and said, why did I do that to you? Well, I was wondering the same thing, you see. I said, you must have had a terrible experience. She said, did you see the man going out when you came in? And I said, yes. Oh, she said, he evidently had come into the store, was unhappy about something, had taken out the whole thing on her. And he was cruel about it. And she stood there taking it as she should, and the feeling inside of her was building up, 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 and it hadn't quite exploded when suddenly he leaves and I walk in. I'm another man. I ask her a question and I got it. So I laughed and said, well, I used to work in the store one time. I think clerks ought to get combat pay anyway. And there's nothing crazier than people. And she laughed about it, and she said, but how can you take it like this? I said, look, it was no problem. She said, yes, but I shouldn't have done it to you. I said, it doesn't bother. It's no problem at all. Well, I made my purchase, and as I was getting ready to leave, I said to her, you have a nice day. She said, I will, because I met you. Now, I could have gone in and said, where's the manager? Got her fired. Maybe she's the sole support of two youngsters. Who knows? Got her fired. That would make a big deal, wouldn't it? Now I'd be a horizontal Christian for sure. But I could have a right to feel the way I do and not exercise that right and turn the whole thing around, exhibiting this Christ-like attitude. How about in the church? Do we have rights? Do I have to agree with everyone? We are as different as the leaves on a tree, as different as the snowflakes. God made us that way. We have different preferences, different likes, different and dislikes. But when we bring a whole group of people to church and we have to make one decision, such as the color of the rug or a style of paneling or something, one decision that matches everybody's likes and dislikes, we run into trouble. So, am I to have no rights at all? On the contrary, I have every right to view my opinion and give my preferences. However, after I have given these and the vote is taken, now is where I must react differently. And here it is. I'll read it to you. It comes from Volume 4 of the Testimonies, page 18. They should feel it a solemn duty to illustrate in their characters the teachings of Christ, being at peace with one another and moving in perfect harmony as an undivided whole. And here is the point. They should defer their individual judgment to the judgment of the body of the church. After the vote is taken, regardless if it goes against me or for me, I say, fine, I support it just like I would if it were my own idea. One of the beautiful examples of this great principle of having rights is found in the case of Abraham and Lot. Abraham had every right to tell Lot when they had trouble with their herdsmen, you take your herds and move off up into the hills and put a buffer zone in here. I'm tired of hearing about it. Because the herdsmen were squabbling over water rights or grazing lands or whatever. But Abraham took Lot, his nephew, up onto a hill. And instead of saying, look, everything you have is a result of my beneficence to you, he said to his nephew Lot, let there be no strife between me and thee, and between thy herdsmen and my herdsmen. We be brethren. Genesis 13, verse 8. Let there be no strife. We be brethren. We're told that this is the noble and selfish spirit of Abraham. How many under similar circumstances would at all hazards cling to their individual rights and preferences? How many churches have been divided, making the cause of truth a byword and a reproach among the wicked? You see, the carnal heart is controlled by harmful emotions. It will inevitably result in inappropriate actions. But the heart which is filled with love for Christ is controlled by helpful emotions, and the actions will be appropriate. Paul said, if thine enemy hunger, feed him. If he's thirsty, give him drink, for in so doing thou shalt heap coals of fire on his head, from Romans 12:20. This always seems so strange to me, because I could just see taking a coal scuttle full of red-hot coals and just putting it on your enemy's head. I thought it's the most unchristian thing that I ever heard of. What are coals of fire? What was he talking about? The positive act is this. If a person wants to fight, you walk away. If he gives you harsh words, you give him a soft answer. If he wants to argue, silence. Douglas MacArthur said that his grandfather gave him some advice one time that he didn't always follow. He said, don't say anything unless you can improve on silence. I've often thought how he could have put that to real good advantage when he was recalled from Korea. If he had simply just sat silent, letting his past record as one of America's great generals stand by itself, instead of trying to defend himself, how much better he would have been. If people treat you with unkindness, treat them with courtesy. This is called the vengeance of kindness. Once you have learned to control your reactions through the grace of Christ, you may have the right to feel the way you do, but you will choose not to exercise this right, and you will find that it is much easier to adapt to any situation. And then we're told that in the day of final account, we shall see that all the obstacles we meet, all the hardships and annoyances that we are called to bear, are simply practical lessons in the application of the principles of Christian life.